Welcome to Worlds Apart. The East-West power struggle, accentuated by the war in Ukraine and rising tensions over Taiwan, has temporarily eclipsed another axis of swelling imbalances and potential troubles, this time between the global North and the global South. Given how dearly developing countries have been paying for the decisions made in the so-called developed world, isn't the time ripe to break this exploitative arrangement? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Sanjaya Barrow, Distinguished Fellow at the United Service Institution of India. Mr. Barrow, it's a great pleasure, great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Delighted to be on the show.
Now,
thank you.
I once heard from a prominent European politician that it doesn't matter whether elephants are fighting or making love, the grass underneath them gets trampled. And if we extend that metaphor to the geopolitical situation in the world today, it's not just the grass that underneath them that gets affected. It's the valleys and the villages, you know, worlds apart, miles away. Do you think Russia and the West are fully aware of the kind of damage that their confrontation is visiting upon third parties?
Well, I'm pretty sure they understand. The question is, what are they doing about it? The fact is that the developing world has been dealing with a very difficult global environment for a long time. I would say for 300 years. I mean, we have been a colony of the British for a long time, and then we had a global system dominated by the West after the Second World War, institutionally dominated also by the West. But even in multilateral organizations have been dominated by major powers. So what is now called the Global South, which is essentially developing countries, or it used to be called Third World in the old days, if you remember, has not been in a good position for a long time. And it's only in the last couple of decades with globalization and new opportunities for growth that, you know, countries like China and India and many other countries in Latin America and Africa have experienced growth. I think the current crisis, international crisis, both the war in Ukraine, but more importantly, all the policy kind of decisions taken as a consequence of the war are hurting us.
Now, India has a very interesting stance here because both the East and the West, both Russia and the United States, are trying to court India to their sides. But India positions itself as a leader, or perhaps the leader of the global South. What does it mean for India's foreign policy stance in practical terms?
Well, first of all, in practical terms, India has always had an independent foreign policy. I mean, from the time we became a republic in 1947, it has had different names. We used to call it non-alignment. Then we talk about strategic autonomy. But essentially, the core of Indian policy towards the rest of the world is to have an independent foreign policy. We took decisions based on our national interest and an understanding that we are a civilizational nation, that India, like China, like Russia, like Europe, or mainland Europe, and many other civilizational entities in Latin America and other parts of Asia, we are a civilizational entity. We have seen ourselves as a country that has a message based on the long history of our civilization, 5,000 a history of our civilization. And therefore, it's a very deeply felt identity that we have to have an independent voice. And whether it was Nehru in the past, or Indira Gandhi, or Atal Bihari Vajpayee, or Manmohan Singh, with whom I worked, everyone has had independent voice in international affairs.
Well, but Mr. Barrow, I think there is definitely this streak of independence in the rhetoric of many Indian leaders. But, and you, by the way, yourself wrote that despite all Washington's efforts to have New Delhi conscripted to a so-called rules-based democratic order, India has a vital interest in upholding a different set of rules, those that would support broader economic development and prosperity. But how grounded is India in this multilateral view? I mean, how free it is from the temptation of you know, getting some credentials of a democratic state from Washington. You mentioned the very long history of your civilization, but when I watch Indian media, I also see that it's very important for many people to sort of feel themselves to be in the good graces of the West, because supposedly the West issues those, you know, good democracy certificates.
Well, I don't think we have ever bothered about certificates. I don't think that's, you know, at least the Indian political leadership hasn't. You talk about the Indian media is very diverse. The real issue for us has always been the fact that because of our colonial history, and English is the most important language in this country, it's a kind of an integrating language, because India is a country of, you know, several languages, and English remains our link with the rest of the world. So there's a much greater influence of the English-speaking world on the way we think, what we read, etc. Plus, the people-to-people contact. I mean, if you look at the numbers of Indians living around the world, most of them are in the English-speaking world, the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, etc. And so, therefore, in the media, you will see that bias. But I think we must distinguish between the rhetoric of the media or the opinion of the media and the views of the government. I think governments in India successively, including the present government, have taken an independent position. We have tried to build our relations with, whether it's with Russia or with China or the United States, or indeed with other countries like Japan, Germany, France, on the basis of our national interest. And it's not as if we have not come under pressure. We have from time to time come under pressure. And I can talk about, you know, various incidents where we have come under pressure. But each time we have come under pressure, I think it is a good fortune that we have had a national leadership that has asserted its independence. I mean, we have just seen recently on the vote in the UN Security Council, India has taken a view of its own. It has not bandwagoned with anybody else.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago, and you wrote about that before, that both the humanitarian consequences of Russia's military operation in Ukraine and Western economic sanctions that were intended to punish Russia for that are hurting the global community to a substantial extent. Do they do that, though, in equal measure? Do you think they could be compared in terms of their impact?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question. I've not looked at the, you know, when you say equal measure, but the fact is that the inflation, global inflation, triggered by the rise in oil prices, triggered by the rise in food prices, and then the disconnect in the financial system, the various economic sanctions imposed by the United States and the NATO powers, all of them together have certainly impacted us. I mean, we in India, we the developing world, have been at the receiving end of the combined effect of all of this. And, you know, you can get into a blame game, who's to blame, whether Russia is to blame or the West is to blame. But I think the fact is that given the history of this conflict, I would argue both sides have to take the blame. I think both
blaming. I mean, blaming is irrelevant in geopolitics because you cannot do anything with that. But the reason why I'm asking this question is because I think nobody would think twice before condemning a war. We all understand that this is the worst possible outcome. The question is whether there was any alternative to that. But I think there's a perception in the international community that sanctions are somehow a more moral and more ecological means of doing politics, even though if we look at the number of people who are affected by those decisions, I think they're much larger than the number of people who are affected by the direct conflict. So I think it's also a very important point to sort of look at the motivations. A contained war for the concrete interest versus essentially a helicopter style action that affects everybody and very, very little consideration for, you know, third parties who have nothing to do with your struggle.
Well, you're right. And that's what I have written in some of my columns, which were published, if you go back to March, April this year, after the beginning of the hostilities, that sanctions, first of all, are a blunt instrument. They do not distinguish the targets. You've seen the impact of, for example, U.S. sanctions on Iran and how, you know, everybody has been impacted by that. We in India have been at the receiving end of Western sanctions for a long time. So sanctions are a blunt instrument. And I think it is true when you say that a conflict between two countries could have been contained within those two countries, which has happened in many other cases in the past. But the minute you have global sanctions, and that too sanctions which in some ways breach the international system. I mean, you take, for example, the sanctioning of the Russian Central Bank. I was reading somewhere that, you know, right through the Second World War, the Bank of International Settlements in Basel in Switzerland never sanctioned the Deutsche Bank, the German Central Bank. Right through the Hitler's campaign, the German banks were not sanctioned. So, you know, there is a discrimination there. And I think sanctioning central banks certainly is something which has hurt us. And most importantly, you know, the pressure in the oil market to try and twist arms and say, don't buy Russian oil, buy Western oil, etc. All of these hurt developing countries. And, you know, many of us in India have been writing this.
Now, Mr. Barrow, this is a fascinating question for me, how the West applies its pressure, because on the one hand, it has many indirect ways of sabotaging its own direct commitments. But on the other hand, if we look at the recent news about OPEC making a decision to lower its oil production, despite very heavy and very active American lobbying, it's clear that Americans' scope of influence, even with its own allies, is somewhat limited. How do you assess Western capacity of getting what Washington wants at this point of time? Do you think the methods of pressure have changed in any way?
Well, first of all, methods have changed in the sense that there's much greater willingness now to use the financial sector as an instrument of pressure. I've been a student of geoeconomics, and you know, when you look at the evolution of geoeconomics, you see that the instruments of sanctions have evolved over time. As I said, in the past, central banks were never sanctioned, but now that is happening. So the financial sector has come into the kind of spotlight as far as sanctions are concerned. But more importantly, I think the change that has happened in the last 20 years compared to the before that, particularly for India, is the globalization of our economy. And in some ways, you see that even with China, I mean, the dependence of Chinese companies on Western markets, for example, the dependence of our companies. So the change in the global system, economic system and trading networks, et cetera, has therefore changed the way in which sanctions are being used, the kind of sanction techniques are being devised. But I would still make a distinction between the decision of the states, of governments. I mean, you talked about OPEC. OPEC is an organization of governments, right? And when it comes to governments, I think there is a greater willingness to stand by national interest. When it comes to private companies, you know, they have their boardroom, corporate boards, and shareholders, et cetera.
Which is also understandable to some extent. Mr. Barrow, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Русофобия оказалась выгодным бизнесом.
Они Украину предали, ограбили и отдали на растерзание американцам. Украину, мою родину.
Эти люди готовились достаточно открыто, финансирование проводилось достаточно широко, и мы знаем всех акторов, кто это финансирование получал.
8 лет двигались ровно в этом направлении, чтобы вот расчеловечить русских и разорвать все связи.
Это результат серьезной работы над историческим сознанием.
Преступление против человечества задокументированных на украинских территориях очень много. И большая часть из них совершена при попустительстве или по прямому приказу нынешнего или прошлого киевского руководства.
Уже они давно вышли из легального поля, давно, значит, действуют другими методами, неконституционными.
Это и есть преступление по нацистскому образцу.
Thank you. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Sanjaya Barrow, Distinguished Fellow at the United Service Institution of India. Mr. Barrow, before the break, we were talking about this somewhat a divergent stance that national governments may have on politics and doing business internationally and private companies. And yet at the same time, I think perhaps you would agree with me that the globalization as we knew it only, you know, 5 or even 10 years ago, it's not there anymore. And the United States, while trying to punish some of its enemies, is undermining these very systems. So let's say, at the horizon of 5 or 10 years going forward, which policies, state-oriented policies or state-oriented intention or private-oriented intention, which of them do you think would prevail?
Well, I think certainly if you're looking at a 5-year term or even a 10-year period, certainly in India, I would see greater involvement of the state. We already have seen a shift in the last 5 years. The present government, the Narendra Modi government, has launched what is called Atmanirbhar Bharat Abhiyan, which is Self-Reliant India program, which is essentially meant to reduce our dependence, particularly for critical technologies, defense technologies, semiconductor chips, you know, food and other artificial intelligence, you know, the new and emerging technologies, to reduce our dependence on other countries and to become much more self-reliant. I joke with my friends in the current ruling party, which is the Bharatiya Janata Party, that Modi is now like Jawaharlal Nehru. This was the policy of Nehru in the 50s of building a self-reliant India, you know, based on domestic capacity and capability. And now, once again, we are in that phase where, because of the challenge of globalization, because of the global trade slowing down, because WTO as a multilateral trading system is no longer working, because of threats of sanctions. I think for all these reasons, and also from an Indian point of view, because of the pressure from China on us, we are trying to reduce our dependence, external dependence, and become more self-reliant. And I think that's the direction at least we in India will go.
Now, you speak about self-reliance and bigger involvement of state in the economy as synonymous things that are related to each other. And I think there's a very strong narrative in the West that whenever a state's role, especially in bigger countries that can challenge the United States, whenever state role is increased, that's equated to autocracy or totalitarianism. But I think we are coming to this very interesting point in history where self-sufficiency or sovereignty are becoming a means of achieving democracy. Am I wrong here? Because it sounds like a paradox, but if more countries are pursuing their own self-interest, the democratic system internationally seems to be improving.
Well, global democracy, I don't know when you say democracy, but what it's certainly doing is to bring the focus back to sovereignty. I think what we saw during the era of globalization was a reduced emphasis on sovereignty. And the idea that, you know, the world is flat. I think Thomas Friedman wrote his book called The World is Flat, that we are all equal, we are trading on equal terms, etc. That is no longer the case. And therefore, nations are asserting their sovereignty. I think that is certainly a fact. As far as democratic systems are concerned, the world has always lived with very, very different types of democracy, and therefore that will continue to be the case. I don't think, you know, the United States or Europe is going to decide what is democracy and what is not democracy.
But isn't that I understand democracy working on a domestic level essentially means that every member of the society or every group has a certain input and it's treated fairly in proportion to its size within the society, that everybody's interests are accounted for. And when we translate that to the international system, it seems to be working, it could be working in the same sort of fashion. So countries big and small, it doesn't mean that they have the same amount of influence, but at least their interests would be taken into account and the global processes could be structured in a way not to penalize or ostracize one or the other. In this sense, do you think global democracy as a way of taking into account various interests and trying to integrate them into the decision making, isn't it possible? Aren't we already moving toward in that direction?
I'm afraid not.
No?
The global system is a power-based system. We talk about, you know, equality of states. The United Nations was constructed on that principle of equality. But even in constructing the United Nations, we created a UN Security Council, of which we are still not a member. And therefore, they were the more powerful and the less powerful. And even within multilateral organizations, so there's the, you know, economic organizations like the WTO, IMF, World Bank, the big economies have a bigger voice. So in the international system, we have never really practiced democracy. It's a power-based system. And the powerful always have their way. So I don't think, you know, that is going to change much. In fact, if anything, what we are now seeing is a reassertion of power rather than a reassertion of a, you know, democratic way of dealing with issues.
Now, one of the most interesting discussions in politicized circles today is about neocolonialism and indeed an effort to reassert your power as a way of preserving your some would say unfair privileges. I think the Russians are really trying to frame their struggle with the West in those terms. They present it as both their own fight for political and economic sovereignty, but also as an effort to create a fair international system. What do you think about that? Do you think Western hegemonic ambitions are colonial at their very core?
Well, it's not just the West. I mean, as I said, when I sit in India and look at the world, we see a hegemon country, which is our neighbor, China, seeking to behave like a hegemon in Asia. And that is why I said that, you know, we are in a world where power is the currency. You know, in this unequal world, developing countries, which is the global South, are seeking space for themselves. I think that is the way I would look at the world today. That the West has always been dominant for the last 300 years, but other countries have played this role of major power, the Soviet Union, which is no longer there. But Russia in its own area is a dominant power. China in Asia seeks to be a dominant power. Some accuse us of being a dominant power in South Asia, that we are like big brother to our smaller neighbors. It's in the nature of international relations that the currency is power, and therefore, the weak shall always fight against the strong. And when you look at colonial systems, which have continued in terms of denial of market access, in terms of denial of technologies, in terms of assertion of intellectual property rights, which maintains a regime of, you know, global inequality, that is what the developing world was fighting against. You know, when we talked about a new international economic order in the 1980s and 90s, and many of us in the developing world wanted changes in the global system, we wanted a much more equitable system. But, you know, that struggle continues.
But if you look at the global disbalances that exist today, it's pretty clear that they're hurting the powerful states to some extent more even than smaller countries, because the United States is no longer capable of maintaining its alliances and, you know, investing in them today to an extent that it used to do that before. I wonder if a more fair distribution is not only a sort of an ideological or moral goal, but the necessity of modern time, because, you know, having your neighbor or your even enemy get something that it wants ultimately serves you as well, because it creates a more predictable situation. Don't you think that the time itself is calling for a more fair distribution of both resources and power?
Well, I think that is why many of us, at least certainly I do, believe that the global system is evolving towards what we call a multipolar system. I think, you know, we saw a unipolar world, we saw a bipolar world. What the direction in which we are moving, and that is certainly the view of the Indian political leadership, and I believe it's probably the view of the Russian political leadership too, that we are moving in the direction of a more multipolar world, a world in which a larger number of countries play a bigger role. I mean, it may not be a perfect democracy, you know, a small country, let's say like Maldives in the Arabian Sea, may not have the same voice as India or indeed.
And neither should it, because its contribution to the global common good is smaller. I mean, power is proportionate to what you bring to the table.
Yeah, so therefore, the direction in which we are moving, in my judgment, is a multipolar system. And the current crisis will only accentuate that process. And I think the West, particularly the United States, I think Europe has come to terms with it. For example, even the French have talked about the multipolar system. If you see the speeches of French leadership.
But they only talk. They don't follow through on that talk.
Well, I mean, you know, it's good that you begin with the talk. I mean, the Americans don't even talk about being a multipolar system. So at least some European countries are asserting their sovereignty, their strategic autonomy. In Asia, we see countries asserting, their kind of autonomy. And therefore, we are moving towards a multipolar system. Now, whether we move fast or slow, it depends on events, you know, like what we are seeing right now. Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you one last question, and this is something that political analysts are rarely asked, but I think is absolutely essential to understanding the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times. I think both Russia and the West ontologically are born of a monotheistic worldview where there's only one, you know, God and one devil, which I think gives their rivalry such an intensity and such a large scope for demonizing each other. India, on the other hand, is a polytheistic culture, which I assume comes with a different understanding of diversity, sort of the structure of diversity, the practical value of diversity, as well as the practical value of power distribution, because within your pantheon of gods, you know, there are stronger gods, there are, you know, less powerful gods, but they are all important and they are all make the pantheon. I wonder if this polytheistic ontology could be more conducive to the to a multipolar world that we've been talking about, especially in the view that India is set to assume the leadership, the presidency of both G20 and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization this year.
Well, that's, first of all, a very fascinating question, and I think it's also a very important question, because that was the way in which we looked at ourselves. In the last 75 years that we have been a republic, that we are multicultural, multi-religious, multilingual, you know, in many ways, a very, very plural nation. And therefore, we bring plurality to our thinking, not just about ourselves, but about the world. Unfortunately, in India, we now have a very intense debate between this pluralist tradition and a growing assertion of, majoritarianism. And I think that's our domestic politics. That is what is happening within the country, where all of us who believe in the strength of pluralism, that, you know, the slogan used to be unity in diversity. That was the foundation of India. And that we should preserve this. We should preserve our diversity, but construct our unity based on our diversity. I think that's the message of the Indian Republic. And I hope that that personality of India as a plural nation remains, so that for the rest of the world, we have a message. I mean, I used to write speeches for Dr. Manmohan Singh when he was prime minister, and he would repeatedly make this point, that India is a plural nation, is a nation of diversity, and therefore brings to the world a new way of looking at things. And that is our strength. And I hope we preserve that character of our nation.
That's not only your strength, but I think that's something that the world is very desperately needing right now. Mr. Bauer, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.